Okay. So, are there any questions? Yes. That would still not help, right? As I remember, what you need is the action has to end, the second action has to end right after the first action. So you needed something like you needed something like this. The second action has to end right after the first action. Right? So starting it after doesn't take care of that problem. That's why Deplas basically said, let's end it. You know, so let's not only consider starting but also ending actions in each epoch. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions? I think, you know, any algorithm can become incomplete because of the search strategy used. Okay, that we understand. I mean, you know, you cannot hold it against them. You know, I mean, it's like you basically wind up talking about, see, every planner sets up two things. Okay, one is it sets up a search space. The other is, if it's an actually implemented planner, it also probably navigates that search space using some search algorithm. When it's navigating, it needs to be, so there are two ways you can be incomplete. One is your search space doesn't have the solution. That is really bad. Okay. The second is that the search space has a solution, but the way you are navigating it doesn't. Okay, and you know, but that's the 471 material. You know, when are the search strategies complete versus incomplete? So that's a different story. Other question?
About the completeness of genome, and I also talk about completeness of decision detox planner is incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them, I think, can be considered a time operator, but the best thing is not complete.
Yeah, but so in general, you can think of it like this. I mean, basically, you can think of ultimately, okay, irrespective of how you do planning in classical planning, the solution is always, I mean, there is a way. I'll get back to your question. So first, I mean, I just saw your comment on blog before coming, so I had an answer, but I'll get to it indirectly, okay? Think about the following way. First, when you have classical planner, irrespective of whether you're doing partial order planning or SAT plan or graph plan or anything, the first question is, what is the solution? Okay, what is the solution in classical planning? It's a sequence of operators. That's it. You know, if you have a sequence of operators, that's a solution. Okay. And given that a solution is a sequence of operators, right, you may be searching in the space of sequence of, to actually search in the space of sequence of operators, instead of directly search in that space, normally in the refinement planning terminology, what are you doing? You define a partial plan, which is a set of constraints whose extension corresponds to a specific set of apparatus sequences, right? Okay. So, in fact, every partial plan in relaxed in classical planning, you know, whether you do partial plans in progression or regression or partial order planning, okay, any partial plan P is essentially a set of operator sequences, okay, and that's what the refinement planning view was. Okay, now one interesting thing is if you, for example, consider regression versus plan space planning, one of the interesting ideas is one can actually say that we talked about this, the partial plans that a regression planner generates in some sense are more constrained than the partial plans that the partial order planner generates, in the sense that if you are considering 0, infinity and putting an action A1 right at the end because you want to support something versus 0, A, infinity, okay, this, if you look at them in the context of the sequence of operators they support, right, this has a bigger set, this has a smaller set, okay. So one idea is to actually say that all of this is, you know, what's called quotienting, in that rather than search directly in the space of sequence of operators, you're searching in a different space, okay, where every element in this higher level space corresponds to sets of sequences, I mean sets of entities in the original solution space. Okay, now if you are searching in the space of quotients, then normally one of the reasons you would be doing it is essentially that the, you know, each partial plan, for example, corresponds to many solutions. So you may be seeing whether it's a plan or not plan, and you're making a decision over a huge number of sequences at one time, as against looking at each sequence separately. Okay. However, for it to be a true quotienting space, you do have to have this idea that this actually generates the equivalence class on this. That means, you know, each partial plan corresponds to a separate set of solutions, okay, and there is no overlap, so that means you need systematicity, and that there are no solutions that are not corresponding to any partial plan. Okay, given every partial plan, so that way, given a sequence here, you can say in the higher space what is the plan corresponding to it, and given a plan, and there would not be more than one plan corresponding to the same sequence. If there is more than one plan, then the quotient searching in the space of the higher level space is not going to have any advantage. Okay, viewed that way, plan space planning is sort of a higher level quotient space than regression planning. Okay, and then you can think of this as you are lifting higher and higher. So each set here is a subset of solutions. Each set here is a bigger subset of solutions. Okay, now having thought about it that way, consider what happens in the temporal planning. What is the solutions in temporal planning? Ultimately, a solution for a temporal planning problem is a dispatch. Irrespective of what your planner is, a solution for a temporal planning problem is a dispatch. Okay, a dispatch essentially says AI, TI for a bunch of actions and the specific time points where they're supposed to start. That's it. Okay, and any set which of AI, TI that you give me is a plan. Okay, and you are, if you really are interested in finding a single solution, that's the space in which you're finding it. Okay. And you could actually argue that rather than search in the space of dispatches, which is basically infinitely large, you know, in this case, in the sequence of operators, especially if you considered bounded length sequences, it's at least a finite space. So it's not as clear why you even want to search in a higher level space. Okay. In temporal planning, the idea of searching in the space of dispatches is sort of a dead idea. Because let's say, you know, there are infinite number of dispatches. Okay. So in a way, the depth, the Bayesian epoch planners, as I was mentioning last time, in some sense, you can make them complete if you consider them to, if they generate every possible dispatch. If they can generate every possible dispatch, okay, then they will be complete. But the problem, of course, is the most obvious way to generate every possible dispatch would involve advancing the clock to every possible time point. And if the time is dense, that means advancing over infinite number of time points. Okay. In fact, you can talk about for every depth plan P, you can talk about its candidate set. So if you want to generate a whole semantics for refinement planning for temporal plans, it would be in terms of candidate sets defined in terms of dispatches. Just as for classical planning, candidate sets were defined in terms of sequence of operators. Okay, and the Bayesian epoch planners will have, you can actually define for each Bayesian epoch, for each SAPA plan, what are the solutions, what are the actual dispatches that are consistent with it. Okay, the problem is SAPA does not generate, you know, the way it splits the search space is such that it would miss. So the if you look at it that way, that refinement would wind up being incomplete, in the sense there would be dispatches that are not part of any of the plans that SAPA is generating at that level. Remember, none of them are complete plans. They're basically a sequence of constraints. The question is, I could play around such that the only solution I have is a very specific dispatch, just as I can play around with my classical planning problem such that my problem only has one particular sequence as its solution, nothing else. And so if your refinement isn't complete, if you miss that particular, I mean, I can, you know, make my problem such that you miss that particular sequence and I can show you are incomplete. So that's why when we talked about incompleteness of refinements, what we said was essentially there is no solution that can be lost. Okay. So I'm more or less agreeing with you in a sort of a long-winded way, but that the candidate set here really is in terms of dispatches. Okay. And the depth suggests an equivalence class over suggests a lifted space over dispatches. Okay, depth planners, except that's not complete. Okay, and then Zeno generates a lifted space over dispatches. That happens to be complete. Okay. Any other points? Any other questions?
We can say we explore the complicated of Geno with, for example, I want to improve the search in the sense that I can use the technique by recall to compose everything from.
Yeah, you can. You can. So I'll talk a little about what, you know, so one very big issue that you have to understand is what is the advantage of basically searching in a space like the depth space, where, and the main advantage there turns out to be that you know exactly what the state of the world is. Given that partial plan, you know exactly what the state of the world is. Okay, the state of the world winds up having two aspects. One is the logical state of the world, which is what are the logical fluents that are actually true by that, you know, given that particular plan. And also, what is the state of the, if you have numeric fluents, what's the state of the numeric fluents? Okay, if you know in the depth, you know, whenever you have a dispatch, you know, given any specific time, you can tell exactly how much of each numeric fluent is available at every point, and exactly how much of whether or not a particular logical fluent is true or false at every point during the plan. Okay, the moment you start not having that sense of state, which partial order planners don't, okay, And you get that sense of state in depth because you add actions only to the beginning. You have a prefix. You never ever go back and add action in the middle. Depth plus is not really a decision epoch planner. Okay, I made up this depth plus last time. Depth plus is a weird planner where you say I will end the action here, which means beginning the action a little earlier. You know, in terms of refinement, that means you're actually changing the states that appeared on the path that led to it. Okay, so it's not a state space planner. Depth plus is not a state space planner, but it tries to keep the same notion of sticking to the epochs. And it turns out, unfortunately, that's not enough. Okay. The reason you're so interested in states is the same both in classical planning and in temporal planning, except it's somewhat more important in temporal planning, you need both the logical. So if you know the state, you know how much of each resource you have, how much, and whether or not a particular logical fluent is true or false. And if you know the state, you also can do reachability heuristics. You know where you are, you know how far you are from somewhere. Okay. Those are the things that you lose if you go to the partial order planner. Okay. Now, REPOP did become somewhat similar in performance to graph plan, but the question was, the biggest question is, if you have partial ordering among tasks, whether or not you can, for example, tell whether the current plan is consistent. Okay, and especially if you have numeric resources. Suppose you want to say that I only have exactly 25. I only have like exactly 25 bicycles. Okay, this plan has large number of actions using bicycles. Okay, my question is there any point if I am executing this plan? And remember, this one plan corresponds to potentially infinite number of dispatches, right? Is there any single dispatch among these infinite number of dispatches which will require more than 25 bicycles at any point during execution? If so, the plan fails, right? The question is, how can you tell that? The way you have to tell that, in essence, is to actually reason over the dispatches, unfortunately. Okay, so the big issue in dealing with partially ordered plans is to know, the advantage as well as the disadvantage is that they don't have state. They don't have state, which means you can add actions anywhere. They don't have state, which means you don't know where you are. And, you know, it's bugged feature. Okay? And in fact, one thing that when we'll talk about TCSP is today, which is basically partial order planning. Remember that you don't need to think about temporal constraint satisfaction problems if you are doing decision epoch planning. Do people understand that? Because you know exactly where each action is supposed to start. There is no mystery. There is no partial ordering. Temporal constraint satisfaction problems are interesting only if you're doing partial order planning, or Zenos of the world. And when you have that, essentially you have to consider, you know, you given a particular partially ordered plan, basically a temporal constraint satisfaction problem, can you tell, for example, if there exists a dispatch which will violate the resource requirement? If so, then you would have to add extra constraints to this plan such that that dispatch would never be mistakenly taken. Remember, imagine the following idea of generating partial, following idea of partial order planning. And notice that I'm going back to partial order planning to give insights into temporal planning with partial order planners. Okay, imagine I have a version of REPOP or UCPOP or whatever, which gives me a partially ordered plan, and says, yeah, some of its topological sorts will work. Some will work, right? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is you don't know which one will work. Okay, now of course it's not the end of the world. In fact, it may well be that if it says there exists at least one topological sort which works, then essentially what it means is it's exponentially hard to find out which topological sort actually works. So the plan isn't done. Okay, so he says, here is a plan. If you write, if you do it right, you should be able to succeed. That's what the Pashada planner is saying. So what you want the planner to say is, think yourself first and make sure that if I do any topological sort of your plan, I would be fine. Equivalent scenario for Zeno would be, think yourself first and then give me a plan such that every legal dispatch of that plan is guaranteed to work. I shouldn't be in charge of second guessing you. Okay, and so the question of course is then, that basically means you need to be able to tell whether or not resource constraints are violated over a partially ordered sequence of actions. Okay, that is, I'm not saying it's impossible, it's just obviously it's much harder than finding, given I tell you that this action starts here, this starts here, this starts here, this starts here, whether or not there is any point where you know, the resource constraints are violated, because that's a single dispatch, whereas a Zeno plan is a potentially infinite number of dispatches. Now it's not necessary that infinite number of dispatches would be hard to reason, I know, would have to be exponential. In fact, we'll notice that simple temporal problems, right, that you read about, they are actually polynomial time to read, you know, to reason about. But if the constraints were disjunctive, then it will be exponential. Okay, that's just the consistency of ordering. But now think about, on the TCS piece, you also have resource constraints. So not only do you have ordering constraints between actions, but I also have this global constraint saying I only have 25 bicycles. That's exactly what scheduling is all about, which we'll do like next class or after we come back from spring break, where somebody already made the plan. And then you're trying to make sure that the global resources, and when they made the plan, they assumed that the resources that they need would be available. Somebody will make it available. So there are bunches of people making plans requiring bicycles, okay? Assuming that the bicycles will be available, since I don't know how many bicycles will be available, I'll just make sure that causally there is nothing wrong with this plan, if enough bicycles are available. So I make my plan, you make your plan, he makes his plan, and all of us are trying to execute this plan. And some centralized scheduler has to say what should be the way in which these plans should be dispatched such that no resource constraints are violated. That's scheduling. And that becomes hard. Because that's exactly because you have partial ordering. Even if in fact individual plans are dispatches, even if individual plans were generated by DEP planners, which are dispatches, if you combine them all, the centralized scheduler essentially has to see them as partially ordered plans, because there is no real reason why, you know, they have to be done. Individual plans, if they are dispatches, the problem is there may not be any way of scheduling them to begin with. Okay. In fact, if the individual plans are all dispatches, then essentially they are telling you, with respect to the, you know, global clock, when should each of these actions start. Scheduling becomes easy, except most of the time you would say it can't be done. Do you understand what I'm saying? Whereas what you should do is, you should give me a plan that requires, that only puts the constraints required for the plan to work by itself. And then I will find any dispatch that's consistent with your constraints. And the moment you do that, then I'm again back into partial order planning. So in fact, if you read the rest of SAPA paper, you would notice that even though SAPA generates dispatch plans, basically decision epoch plans, in the end, it spends a lot of time trying to deorder them and figure out exactly what are the constraints it really needs on the action start times. And rather than give specific start times, says these are the constraints I want. So in some sense, it's like using a state space planner to generate an action sequence and then remove orderings to make it a partially ordered plan. You may think, what's the point? There is a good point for it, because you want to tell, if you want to give your plan to a centralized scheduler, you don't want to put too many constraints on it. You want to put the constraints that are required for your plan to work. That's it. No more. Okay, so you deorder it, and then that becomes a partial order plan for the scheduler. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So some of these resource issues that you mentioned, they can be, so can't we make, there can be a unified resource handling framework, like something of the sort of what I think
we'll talk about it. No, we will have to talk about resources in scheduling as well as in planning in general. Yeah.
Especially with respect, I mean, I guess I'm thinking of the problem, there's two problems when you have these partially ordered plans. One of the problems is that the number of candidates for total ordering is quite large.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that renders this reasoning over resources harder. So if you can come up with some framework for reasoning over resources,
yeah, I mean, no, but basically there are frameworks. We will find ways of doing that, you know. All I'm saying is that's when the partial ordering comes and bites you, okay? It's all about pushing the disjunction into the search space, you know, ultimately. That's the general idea. If you push the disjunction into the search space becomes huge and big, okay? But on the other hand, the per node cost would be cheap. If you keep the disjunction with yourself, right, then the search space could be smaller, but per node cost would be larger. And, you know, that's a general version of, a specific version of that is what comes and bites us in the resources too. Because in the case of partial order plans, then you essentially are keeping the disjunction. You are essentially saying this single plan corresponds to a disjunction of legal dispatches. Okay, and some of them are legal, and some of them actually, you know, take care of the resources. Some they don't. Some don't. You know, in a way, you were only supposed to give one single dispatch. That's what a partial temporal. You know, again, I hope actually, this is sort of a almost circular reasoning, but it's not circular. Okay, the idea is really for temporal plans. On one hand, I said all you needed was dispatches. But really, that's not true, because if you are ever going to be part of a bigger framework where your plan and somebody else's plan and somebody else's plan would be scheduled together, you don't want dispatches. You want partially ordered plan. You basically want something bigger than dispatches, something which is, you know, you want to give a set of legal dispatches. Okay, that's one point. The other point is that from the point of view of search, the search space would be much larger if you are searching in the space of dispatches. So if all you wanted was, you can think any which way you want, but when you talk to the scheduler, give it a partially ordered plan. That can be done. You can basically do, you know, depth planning and then give a deordered version to the scheduler. Okay, and the whole discussion last two classes was that unfortunately, that's incomplete, okay, in the sense either you have infinite branching factor because you have to consider all possible time points to extend to, or you will be incomplete. So you would actually say there is no plan when there is a plan. Okay, so there is no deordering phase anymore. You know, unless you actually come up with a legal dispatch, you can't deorder it. So then you have to consider actually doing planning in, you know, without constraining position constraining action. So in fact, one terminology that I like even more than partial order and contiguity, you know, when we talked about classical planning, we talked about contiguity constraints, which means two actions should come right next to each other, and precedence constraints, right? Actually, there's a more general way of talking about it once you come to temporal planning. One is position constrained, and that's what this one is. And the other is order or precedence constraint. Okay, when you position constrain, you're talking about a dispatch. You're saying this action appears exactly at the following time position. Okay, and that helps certain things because you will know exactly where you are. Yes.
What we're doing progression in temporal planning is that it's incomplete there, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we want to do it complete, then we have infinitely possibilities there.
you have to basically, there doesn't seem to be any easy way of advancing the clock to less than all possible time points. And we know that advancing the clock to all possible time points is a dumb idea, because that just increases the number of branch points. And if it's dense time, it's infinite number of branch points. But it would have been very reasonable if you could somehow advance the clock to points that you know are the only useful points to consider. But the, much of that discussion that we had and that paper that was that we had was saying that there may well be only a few points that you that wind up being the right points, but you would never know what they are upfront until the plan is over. Okay, so the only way you can have completeness is to branch over everything. Yes, no, again, that is the interesting thing. That's a very powerful intuition, and please understand that that's the reason Saffa lived from 2001 to 2008. Right? and we got large number of citations, a large number of other people did this kind of planning. It's a powerful intuition. It makes quite a reasonable sense to think that, you know, something interesting must happen. What that paper is essentially pointing out is that something is interesting is happen, what might happen actually is that something downstream, there may be something interesting happening, something arbitrarily downstream, which would cascadingly say that this part is interesting too. But how would you know that? You know, when you're going forward, how would you know until you get there that, oh, this point is important too? Deplos unfortunately doesn't work because it can be killed. That was the whole point of that paper. I mean, yeah, we tried. I mean, again, I would think that if you could reduce the number of epochs, or at least give up on certain types of completeness, maybe that's another way. So there may be between Deplos and Zeno, there may be other points where I doubt whether they would be complete fully, but maybe they would only be incomplete for certain kinds of plans which nobody cares about. Okay, I mean, I think it's a powerful intuition that, you know, we should only consider points where interesting things happen. But unfortunately, what if whether or not interesting thing happens here depends arbitrarily downstream on what is happening there? You could be right. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I don't know how to make those. Okay, so all these basically, that paper doesn't prove that Dirichlet epoch planning is dead for sure, but that all that it shows is the existing Dirichlet epoch planners are definitely dead, and we tried to think about a way of, you know, resurrecting it. We couldn't, but maybe you could. Okay. LP planner. Yeah, there are. There are. In fact, there are variations of them. So, in fact, what happens is, one of the things is, in the time temporal planning, there are two trade-offs. From the point of view of just time, you would like to think in essentially order constrained, not position but order constrained. From the point of view of metric resources, you want to think of position constrained. Okay. So what people do is they'll give up one or the other. Okay, so there are numeric state space planners which work very well. There is this thing called metric FF. All it does is it handles, on top of FF, it handles numeric variables. We should talk about it at some point of time. And it does quite well. And in fact, numeric, that particular problem, I would be very surprised if you can come up with a partial order planner which is good, because that's sort of made up for exactly knowing what your state is. Okay? And similarly, there are pure temporal planners, many pure temporal planners, which basically don't decide exactly where to start an action. They think in terms of ordering constraints between actions. Okay, let me actually show you something This was there in the end of that paper, since we made this much of a discussion. It looks almost like a state-based planner and it isn't. And that's a cute thing, because once you go from classical planning to temporal planning, you know, there are interesting changes. You know, so for example, in this case, all we are doing, you know, there is this planner that Will talks about at the end of HK 2007 paper called Tempo, which is essentially a way of lifting over the dispatches, where there is, in essence, all you know is that there is a total ordering. There is a total ordering between the end points and the start points of the action. That's all. Okay, now it turns out that's not a constraint, that's not a huge constraint, because even if you have total ordering over end and start points of the actions, it could still have all the concurrency. Okay, so all I'm saying is, for every action, I think in terms of two classical actions. This is basically what we talked about before, remember, like every durative action can be split into two classical actions with a causal link between them. Okay, so there is a light match, beginning of the light and ending of the, beginning of the light match, ending of the light match, beginning of the fixed fuse, ending of the fixed fuse. Now the interesting thing, especially in PDL 2.1, is effects can only be either start or end. There is no in between. So in fact PDL is actually tailor made for just start and end points. Only interesting things only happen in the beginning and the end. And the other overall preconditions are causal links from the beginning to the end. Okay, so consider doing planning where essentially what you do is you start doing progression on these actions. In essence, I mean, sorry, not progression exactly. Yeah, progression on these actions. In the sense, you consider. Let's see, what am I trying to say? Not progression. You consider total orderings over these endpoints of the actions. Okay, so for example, you consider starting the fixed action, then you can either consider any of these actions which are applicable in the logical state after this. Okay, so for example, after the fixed action, I can put the light action. After the light action, I put the other end of the fuse action, and then I do the match action end. This looks almost like a state space plan, almost, right? In particular, I would know exactly what is the logical state after each of these points. And to the extent logical state is what was helping reachability heuristics, you could potentially use reachability heuristics to reason about, you know, reachability of these plans, these partial plans. Okay, but the big difference is, I never told you what specific time point is fixed starting, what specific time point is light starting. I only have precedence. So there is an actual simple temporal problem underneath that is being solved to decide what are the legal dispatches. So it is really a partial order planner, which looks like a state space planner if you are thinking of it as a classical planning. Now it's a vaporware planner, it doesn't actually exist. Okay, except we'll think that there's this paper that been submitted to IIII this year that might actually be doing planning this way. I don't quite know. I have to read that paper myself. But that's one way where you can have best of all worlds, which is both the logical state, okay, and still not having to decide the exact position. Okay. And you know, that can be shown to be complete. That can be shown to be complete because you don't talk about. So the one thing that you don't do is the scheduling decision. You don't decide when to start the action. You only consider action orderings as needed by causality. Okay? But scheduling decisions are important when there are external resources, because causality is not enough. This might have been a great plan if there were enough bicycles. Okay, but that is somebody else has to deal with that later on. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I was going to quickly go through this. I got 9 people give me feedback. I'll post them unedited so that you get to see it. If those 9 are indicative, apparently there isn't anything particularly bad that's going on. Mostly people seem to be too happy. One person did say that it's too overwhelming and that everything should be the coverage and the speed should be reduced significantly. And that one person worried whether that would affect their grade. I haven't been able to figure out exactly what their IP address was, so it doesn't affect their grade. I'm thankful that people took it seriously, and if there's a problem, you should talk about it. That's the whole point. In fact, I myself feel that I should just end the course right now because I would get very good evaluations. For the rest of the semester, it's all going to go down. So, readings, a mixture of people apparently are reading. I can't tell based on the general faces whether anybody is reading, but they seem to think that they're reading either at least before or going back after the class, which is okay with me. Homeworks, majority seem happy that the homework forced them to go back and read the papers, and that's what mostly they are doing. And one person made the very right point that homework should not be just making me read the papers, it should be making me extending the papers, which is right too. Okay, it's just a question of you have this guy and you have this guy in the 12 of you right here. Okay, and so there is a tricky issue there. I agree that homework should be more challenging, but I was mostly using them to force you to at least read the papers. If you already read the papers, unfortunately, you would be doing busy work and not learning anything much more. But I'm hoping that there are enough other ways in which you can show off all other things that you know. There's blog comments, and you can make up open-ended connections. Plus, setting open-ended homeworks are harder on me. Okay, that's reality. Okay. I could actually do that partial order planning idea, which is I give the homework and I don't know whether there's a solution or not. And then if you find it, you will tell me that there's a solution. By the way, there is a great story that I may have told some of you. It's actually a good story given what we'll be doing today. TCSPs can be thought of as linear programs. Okay? And linear programming, the best algorithm for linear programming is by George Danzig. Who did the simplex algorithm, which is actually exponential, but it seems to work better than the so-called polynomial algorithms most of the time. Okay, so there is this great story about Danzig when he was a grad student in Berkeley, one day he came late to the class and he looked that there were some problems on the home board, so he took it down on the notebook, and then he thought there were homework problems, so he worked on them, and then he was late. He didn't submit it on time, so he thought. So then 3 days later, he went and gave the professor, here are the solutions. I'm sorry, I was late in submitting my homework. And then the professor said, yeah, leave it there and, stop bothering me. And then about like 10 days later, when George Danzig was sleeping, his professor, these were the good old days where professors know where the students live. So he came and knocked on his door and woke him up. And he said, my God, you solved an open problem. You have to write a paper now. It turns out that the things that this guy saw on the board were open problems. And, the professor did say, these are some of the open problems in this area. Except this guy came late and there was no recording, so he just assumed this is homework. I would love to have that kind of a thing. But, coming up with problems which are almost open, but somebody knows the solution, is actually harder. Okay, so I admit that it's hard to make this guy happy. Semester project, majority seem to be getting started and want to spend time on their project rather than doing homework, etc. So they seem to be happy. I will see what actually happens to the semester project at the end of the semester, I guess. Plus, I guess on Wednesday, I'll know actually what people are doing. Interactivity, people seem to think that there is enough discussion. Today was a lot of discussion, but probably some days people are sleeping, but at least as long as people think there's enough interactivity, that's fine. One person, however, thought that I should force people to discuss, maybe one idea. I also think that originally I thought there'll be a lot more interactive discussion on at least the blogs, but that didn't happen. because we don't have note taking, and I'm not asking people to think of specific things. So that's why I'm forcing you every week, you must say something on a blog. And you too already are ahead of the game, you know, so you get epsilon 1, epsilon 2.
Okay.
Yes!
Okay.
So two guys have already epsilon 1, next epsilon 2 extra. That's good. But I think they were actually good points, by the way. I mean, both of what was said. I mean, I guess even if it's, I mean, my hope is that if somebody thinks of something, then other people can answer it right away. I was, in your case, I knew what the answer was as soon as I saw your question, but I was hoping somebody else would use it to their advantage, because that would take care of 1 week's worth of talking. You could say, Brandon, wake up, this is what the answer is, and they could have done that, but nobody did. So that's fine too. If you actually find what other people, what's the error in other people's question is, that would be okay, because sometimes we don't know. You know, you have to read it before you figure it out. Okay, so that's basically where it is. As I said, I'll post them all, and then you can tell me if I'm, you know, creatively reinterpreting what is written, and if so, you can tell me that. Okay. So what I'm going to do is temporal constraints, which are actually a beautiful technique. We've been using them in the background. We were saying, you know, if you are doing partial order plans, you need to have some sort of constraints on the time points of the big, you know, actions. And I start off, when I describe Zeno, I provided those linear constraints between the time points, saying T1 minus T2 is less than 4, etc., etc. But we didn't directly, specifically talk about what does it mean to check for the consistency of those constraints. Now, of course, since they were linear constraints, you could have just used linear programming. In fact, just the first phase of linear programming, you know, checking whether a set of linear constraints are consistent. That could have been done, okay? Simplex first phase to figure out whether it's consistent or not. As far as the planner is concerned, all it needs to worry about is the current partial plan, is it already dead? If it is dead, it's not worth refining it any further. Okay? But we would take that problem out of just the middle of the planning, where in planning it's a sub-subroutine. Right, you know, posting temporal constraints and checking their consistency is a sub-subroutine. Okay, but it also becomes important for scheduling, and it also becomes important for people who don't want to generate plans but just want to reason about the plan. Okay, so all said and done, temporal constraints, they have their own little, you know, constituency of people who talk about, you know, what are the effective ways of reasoning with them, what's the effective ways of solving them, and you know, that's what we're going to do today a little. So you can talk about temporal constraints in terms of qualitative temporal constraints. All you are saying is this is before that. Okay, that's all. Or you can talk about metric constraints where you say it should happen at least these many units before and should not happen after these many units are before. So the actual, you give distances between the time points. Okay, clearly this is obviously more interesting for us. But qualitative temporal reasoning is just as important. You know, people can give stories, you know, which is just in English, and then you may be interested. This could be a nice GRE analytical question where they'll give a bunch of these statements, and then you have to see whether or not the temporal constraints involved in those statements were actually consistent together. And it could be quite hard. How hard? It turns out that in terms of qualitative constraints, so now before you came here, in classical planning, we had temporal constraints. Yes? Those were the precedence constraints. Were they qualitative or quantitative? Were they qualitative or metric? In the classical planning, the temporal constraints were qualitative because each action was a single point, and you're saying this action is before this action is after this action, and so on. And given a set of precedence constraints, checking whether they are consistent or not was polynomial. As long as for each pair of actions, you only give a conjunctive precedence, a single precedence constraint. So you can say A is before B, or you say A is after B. You don't say it's either A is before B or C is before D. You don't get to say that. If you have disjunctive ordering constraints, then checking the consistency of a set of disjunctive ordering constraints is NP-complete. Okay, so you already knew that checking whether a bunch of temporal constraints you agreed to respect is overcommitting yourself or not. okay, and it only becomes harder once you come to durative actions, because once you come to durative actions, in fact, an action is an interval of time, really, okay. So you could talk about temporal constraints, the qualitative constraints could be between intervals, or you can think of this interval and talk about the beginning and ending of the points, in which case they will be between points. Now, there are actually, you know, people who hold that you need both points and intervals, but for our discussion, I'll act as if they're equivalent, okay? Although the chapter that I sent you has some interesting commentary and, you know, references to people who think you need ability to discuss both intervals and points, and that, you know, a point is not just a small interval, okay? But I'll act as if, you know, we can either discuss your constraints in terms of intervals or in terms of endpoints of an interval, okay? And then if you are thinking of constraints on the endpoints of the interval, you can also talk about metric constraints. Instead of just saying before or after, you can say this much before. That would be TCSP, okay? Now what's interesting about intervals is that there are 13 possible relations between a pair of intervals, which is sort of comes up as like a surprise if to people. You know, if I ask you, given two intervals, how many possible relations can there be between them? I don't think you would say 13, you know, unless you have already thought about the problem. But there are 13 different relations, okay? Because, you know, you can have x before y, x before y, or x meets y, or x overlaps y, or x is during y, or x starts y, or x finishes y, or x equals y. And for each of these, except this one, there is a y-oriented constraint. That's why there are 13. Okay, and then now, if you have constraints between intervals, normally you have to say what are the constraints. So you say, you know, the simple constraint. So when you have simple constraints between two points, it would be A is before B. I don't get to say A is before B or B is before D. That would be a disjunctive constraint. Okay. In terms of intervals, the simple constraints would be any one of these. Oftentimes, you probably don't know enough about the intervals to say that only one of these constraints actually holds between those intervals. Instead, you are more likely than not to say that X is either before or meets Y, or X is either before or meets or overlaps Y. So that's the disjunction, okay? Except the interesting thing is the disjunction now is between just a pair of entities. One thing I want you to remember as we do this whole discussion is most temporal constraint formalisms only model binary constraints, okay? For those of you who remember the CSP discussions, CSPs can be binary CSPs or non-binary CSPs. In a binary CSP, all constraints are between exactly a pair of variables. The great thing about binary CSPs, for those of you who remember the discussion on CSPs, is the constraint graph for binary CSP is a real graph. Okay? Because you'll put an edge between two vertices, in a constraint graph, the variables are the vertices, and the edges are, there is an edge if there is a constraint linking those two variables. If you have NRE constraints, then that will become a hypergraph. And it's not as interesting. You know, the hypergraph analysis is not anywhere near as easy or interesting as, you know, simple normal graph analysis, okay? So most of the work in CSPs already is oftentimes done in terms of binary CSPs. And the most of the work in temporal CSPs definitely is done only in terms of binary temporal CSPs, even though there are non-binary constraints, right? In fact, A is before B or C is before D is a non-binary constraint. And in fact, this happens even if you have durative actions. So suppose I have this action, you know, it has A start, A end, and B start, and B end. I want to probably say things like, is either B ends before A starts, okay, or B starts after A ends. And that's a non-binary constraint, because it's in terms of four different time points, not two actions. Okay? So you have to keep that in mind, you know, but it is still quite useful to talk about binary CSPs and binary temporal CSPs and understand their framework. Okay, yes.
This point can also be used to model the layers of concurrency that can be allowed between actions.
Meaning what?
Meaning something like, so this is actually like mutex within your planning graph. So two actions can be concurrent with each other, but three of them taken together, or you know, three of them taken together are mutex.
So NRE mutexes, you're saying, yeah. It's sort of like, I mean, NRE mutex is an NRE constraint. A mutual exclusion is a binary constraint. If you think of a mutual exclusion as a binary constraint, a non-binary mutual exclusion is an NRE constraint. But that's just a syntactic point still, though. I mean, I'm not quite sure. So anyway, one of the interesting things is, so you can give, you can describe a bunch of temporal intervals in terms of you know, the constraints that hold between them. And normally, more likely than not, you would have disjunctive constraints between a pair of intervals. So for example, either A meets B or A starts B. So normally, you would say, if you can have a constraint graph for a bunch of intervals. Interval constraint graph, you know, the textbook chapter that I sent you talks about it. So it will say A is connected to B, and it would say meets starts. That means it meets R starts. Okay, that's the way they describe the temporal graph, the constraint graph. Okay, suffice it to say that given a bunch of these constraints on pairs of, you know, the pairwise constraints on a bunch of you know, intervals, checking whether it's consistent is NP hard. Okay, unless, and there are special cases which are polynomial. One specific special case is where each of these are singletons. That would be a polynomial case. Okay. Anytime you have disjunction, it's NP hard. Okay. So that's one idea. That's with respect to looking in terms of intervals. There's a huge amount of literature in this area where people talk about specific subclasses that are tractable still. Okay. And then the other idea is to give up on the intervals and talk in terms of the beginning and ending points of the intervals. Okay? And if you do that, all you want to talk about is before equal to after. That's it for all the time points. So if you have an interval x, you will have x plus and x minus. So x minus is the beginning, x plus is the end, I think. Yeah. X before, no. No, x plus is the end and x minus is the beginning. Okay, so x before y would be written as x plus y is less than y minus. How much less? I don't care. So it's still a qualitative constraint, and clearly you can write every one of those 13 relations in terms of these points. Okay, notice, of course, that each of them become more than one point constraint, except they're conjunctive still. So my heuristic that disjunction is the big bad thing still holds, because individual constraints, if every pair only has one constraint, then even when it's converted, it will still have to be polynomial, right? I mean, if it is polynomial in the interval version, then it has to be polynomial in the point algebra version. Okay, and it would be. Because in this particular case, because even though this seems to have two constraints between x, you know, this one constraint becomes two pieces, but they're conjunctive. Okay. And then, so again, one of the things is that you can, let's see. Okay, no, let's go forward. Okay. So those are both just qualitative ways of talking about temporal constraints. Okay, so you don't have any actual amount of time passage between. One thing that you can do is add time, and we will discuss addition of time in the context of point algebra. Okay, so you want to talk about metric time. I mean, it's always time. It's just now we have metric time. You want to say this much time passage is allowed. Okay, so the simplest form of constraints that people talk about are of this. between two time points, the difference between two time points is bounded from below by 10 and above by 30. So it's in that interval. Okay. So there is some slack, you know, the t plus of going, so for example, going to the store takes at least 10 minutes and at most 30 minutes. So the t plus of store minus t minus of store is between 10 and 30. Notice that in this particular case, it's actually not, it's the same action, going to store action, which had a variable duration. It's, you know, that's the interesting point here. But it is with respect to those two time points you talk about beginning and ending. Okay. So here, bread should be eaten within a day of baking. So t plus of baking minus t minus of eating is less than or equal to a day. That's an interesting point. This actually is saying, what is it saying? If you start eating the bread before the day is over, so it's like if you start eating the bread after 23 hours 59 minutes, it's still okay. If you're a slow bread eater, you know, it can still be fine. That's what that particular constraint says. And if you want the ending of the eating to be over, you must have written t plus of eating. The distinction, the t plus of baking, so right now you're talking about t plus of baking and t minus of eating. You really want to, if you want the eating to be over within the day, then you have to consider, you know, the other one. But I get to say, that's a good point. I mean, I'm not trying to yell at that one constraint there, but I can differentiate between exactly what I want to say. Do I want the bread to be, are you supposed to start eating the bread before the day is over? Are you supposed to be done with eating the bread? Okay. Now, if I have, one thing of course is, if I have qualitative inequalities between, qualitative relations between, you know, time points, that means I don't quite know, you know, all I know is x plus is before y minus. Okay. It can be essentially written as x plus minus y minus is, on one side is minus infinity, or a really large negative number, and the other side is zero. So that's one way you can convert qualitative constraints into metric constraints. So in a way, you can do metric constraints as, you know, so you can, if you know how to deal with metric constraints, you can do this kind of a conversion, and you're also handling qualitative constraints. Okay? Which actually makes you wonder, you know, for example, while you're doing this, one way you can check whether it all makes sense or not is to consider what you know about, you know, single time point precedence algebra from the classical planning, and then see whether or not those results hold in, you know, temporal planning in the TCSP. Okay, so these are the kinds of constraints you have in TCSPs. So basically you have, you can have unary or binary constraints. Unary constraints essentially are just saying this point in itself, xi, is in itself is between a0 and b0. And binary constraints are saying the difference between two points is within an interval. Okay. Unary constraints are a single variable, binary constraints are between two variables. Except all the constraints are in this very specific form, you know, the difference between two numeric variables. That's the only kind of constraint that you have. Now, you would call this kind of constraints, if you have, you call them a temporal network, a temporal constraint network. And the special case where you don't have any, so one interesting thing, of course, is that you can actually have, one of the things that I'm saying here is that you could say a0 less than or equal to xj minus xi less than or equal to b0, or a1 less than or equal to xj minus xi less than or equal to b1. That means I can actually have disjunction of intervals. Okay, so the previous thing that I'm basically, so this one, bread should be eaten within a day of baking. Instead, suppose I want to say bread should either be eaten within a day of baking or after one whole week is over. Maybe after one whole week is over, it becomes so much like a rock, it has its own complete different taste. Okay? So that's my disjunctive constraint now. Okay? So I now have either within this interval, the one day interval, or after the 1 week, maybe, you know, any number of days. So that would be a disjunctive constraint. Okay, so the important thing is that the intervals would be disjunctive. Okay, And none of them are binary constraints, they're all NRE constraints. I'm sorry, none of them are NRE constraints, they're all binary constraints. And if there is no disjunction anywhere, then they are called simple temporal networks. Okay? And those would be the ones that you would expect to be easier to solve. They would be polynomial to solve. Okay? And here's the way the constraint graph would look. You know, if you have binary constraint satisfaction problems, you can always write a simple graph where vertices are the time points and the edges essentially are the constraints between them. Now, not only do you get to say in the normal constraint graph, you just write the name of the constraint. Here you can actually say the specific interval that constraint represents. And if a constraint is a disjunctive constraint, then you write all the intervals. Just like, remember I had, so here, A is either meets or starts B. I'll write both of them. Similarly here, 0 is 10 to 20 with respect to 1. That means 1 minus 0, the time point of 1 minus time point of 0 is bounded from below by 10 and above by 20. Okay, and then this one has two different intervals. And this one again, one interval, two intervals, etc. Okay, in this case, this is a disjunctive temporal constraint problem because you have two intervals and you have more than one interval and at least one constraint. That's what it is. Okay. Now, you may be worth thinking about this, the difference between TCSPs and CSPs. Obviously, TCSPs are a kind of CSP. Okay. However, the domains of the variables are totally ordered. Normally, in a CSP, you know, a map coloring problem is a CSP, and the colors are the values. So those are the domains, and the country names are the variables. Okay, but it's not that the colors have any ordering between them. It's not that red is somehow more important than green, green is somehow less important than yellow. Colors are just colors. Time points, on the other hand, have a total ordering. Okay, that actually helps a lot. It's a particular kind of constraint satisfaction problem where time points have total ordering. The values have total ordering, and furthermore, they're actually continuous. Okay, this is a feature, this is kind of a bug. Continuous means there are infinite number of points. Okay, so if you think in terms of composite assignments that are consistent, normally given a TCSP, there may be, if it's a consistent TCSP, there could be an infinite number of assignments for the start points of each of those, for the actual, so an assignment for a CSP normally is giving the values to each of the variables such that all the constraints are satisfied. Okay, in the context of TCSP, it would be giving a time number here, time number here, time number here, time here, time here, such that all these constraints are satisfied. Now, even if in fact it is a consistent set of constraints, there could be infinite number of such time points. You have to just understand that. Okay, so there is no such thing as enumerating all the solutions. This is one important difference between normal CSPs and TCSPs, because this is a kind of CSP where you have infinite number of potential solutions. So normally what you wind up doing is, given a constraint problem like this, you want to compute what's called a minimal network. Okay, a minimal network is a network which has the same solutions as this network, and every constraint in that network is the tightest it can be. Okay, every constraint in this network is the tightest it can be. And that means, so here is the TCSP N1 is considered minimal network if there is no other network N2 that has the same solutions as N1 and has at least one tighter constraint than N1. Now the question is, what is tightness of a constraint? Okay, a tightness of a constraint is essentially defined in terms of, if you have two variables, okay, the tightness of the constraint is how many potential composite assignment, how many composite assignments of these two variables are consistent with the constraint. Okay, it's simple enough to see that if I say x1, x2 and the interval 1 to 2. And another one, x1, x2, the interval minus 10 to plus 10. Which is tighter? 1 to 2. Because they're both infinite number. But this is a tighter constraint because there are composite assignments for the other one which are not going to be consistent with the first one. But not vice versa. However, having said that, one interesting thing to notice is, in making a constraint tight, you might fragment it. Okay, here is a cute point to understand. So if you consider A13B versus A-10 to +100B, clearly 13 is tighter than -10 to +100. Okay, how about this? Suppose I also have A13B, A1345B. Is that more or less tight than A13B? So I'm saying A1345B versus A13B. Clearly, everything that's consistent with this guy is also consistent with this guy, but not vice versa. So A13 is still tighter than the disjunctive constraint. But sometimes I can write a disjunctive constraint which is tighter than the conjunctive constraint. That's actually the more worrisome thing. Oftentimes, to make the constraint be as tight as possible, you would have to arbitrarily break it into small, small pieces. Okay. So in fact, A13B is tighter. A13B is tighter than the constraint 0 to 10B, but it's looser than the constraint A1 to 1.5. 1.6 to 1.9, 1.9 to 2.3, 2.3 to 4.8, 5 to 6B. This is a tighter constraint than A0 to 10. Even though this looks smaller syntactically, it allows many more composite assignments to A and B, whereas some of those assignments are violated now because they're not allowed anymore. Especially in dense time, it's very easy to take, a constraint to have a constraint where the tighter version of that constraint becomes arbitrarily syntactically large. Okay, and oftentimes we wind up, and unfortunately, most of the processing cost of constraints depends on their syntactic representation. So in trying to make a network tight, you might actually make the constraints more and more fragmented. This is normal. You should be surprised if it doesn't happen. You shouldn't be surprised if it happens. Okay? So reducing the expectations such that things are supposed to be bad, but in the context of simple temporal problems, it turns out fragmentation doesn't happen. Okay? Now, so the interesting thing, of course, is if I can compute the minimal network, given a constraint network, if I can compute the minimal network automatically, okay, then the advantage is that I can answer every potential question I might have about a temporal constraint problem. And what are those potential questions? These they are. Okay, if I get a bunch of temporal constraint, bunch of constraints on a bunch of variables, the usual questions I have is the current TCSP consistent? Planners would like to know that. Because if it's already dead, why extend it? Okay? What are the feasible times for each of the variables xi? What are the feasible start times? What are the feasible durations between a pair of variables given the network? Okay? And there may be something which says, oh, you guys are pretty much, there is no real constraint between you, or it's a very loose constraint. So for example, I can say X must occur between 2 to 3 to Y, Y must occur between 2 to 3 to Z, and then I give a constraint saying X could occur between -infinity to +infinity to Z. But I don't really mean it. It looks like, it's basically like me saying you can have all the fun you want, but for the fact that you must do this homework and you must do this term paper and you must do this blog comments, etc., etc., etc. And then you realize that the fun you can have is probably not all that much, depending on how you define fun. I'm hoping that you actually increase your fun. But the point is, the constraints that I have indirectly, actually, so that the effective constraint between two variables is a function of all the constraints between other variables. And when you compute the minimal network, you actually realize the effective constraint between the two variables. And that would become tighter. Okay? And so, on furthermore, more interestingly, using my example of this homeworks, etc., it would also become syntactically, it will become tighter. You have less time to have fun. But not only that, the time for fun is fragmented. So, you can only have fun between like maybe 11 to 11:30 after the homework is done. But then again, about 12:15 onwards, you have to do something else. So again, you cannot have fun at that time. So it would be, you know, it's tighter and it's fragmented. Okay, that's exactly what happens when you make the minimal network. What are the feasible durations? What is the consistent set of times? This is important because given a set of constraints between variables, you need to know what are the dispatches that are consistent with this plan. Somebody has to find that. Okay, and that's basically, you can read off the dispatches if you know the minimal network. Okay, and what are the earliest possible times for each action given the constraints? What are the latest possible times? These are all the questions you can ask potentially, and it turns out all of them can be answered if you just know how to convert a TCSP into its minimal network. It turns out that there is a very, so here is an example of a TCSP. This says 0, 1, 10, 20, 1, 3, 30, 40, and it also says 0 to 3, 0, 100. But the real minimal version of this essentially says 40, 60 is the one that you need, because this is too loose. If you use these two constraints, you actually realize that between 0 and 3, the tighter constraint is 40, 60. Now, in saying that, I am talking about what's called composition of constraints, as well as intersection of constraints. Okay, so if I have two constraints between 0 and 3, one says 40-60, one says 0-100, do I really have two constraints? They're conjunctive. So I only have the intersection of those constraints. So the intersection operation is essentially, if you have two intervals, the intersection operation is the parts where those intervals overlap. And if it's a disjunctive set here and a disjunctive set here, then you have to consider all the overlaps between all the disjuncts. Okay, so it would be, for example, if I have T, which is a disjunctive interval like this, and S, which is a disjunctive interval like this, then the intersection would be exactly that part, that part, that part, because those are the only places there are in actual overlaps between the intervals. Okay, that's the intersection operation. The other operation that you're interested in is the composition operation. I'll take one more minute and you get to go. And then, because next time when we come back, you can tell me that you understood. And you know, depending on whether you understood or not, we'll decide how much more time to spend on this. Composition essentially is this simple idea that if you have 10 to 20 and 30 to 40, then when you compose those two constraints, then it's 10 plus 30 is the earliest, and the lower bound would be 10 plus 30, upper bound would be 20 plus 40. Okay, that's why it's 40-60. Except if you have disjunctive, then you have to consider all possible pairs and consider all the possible pairs, upper and lower bounds added up. And if you need a definition, there is a definition exactly as to what you are doing. Okay, now, that's the slide that you would look at more carefully, and we, you know, if you have any questions, we'll talk more next time. But basically, it turns out there's a very simple idea to make minimal temporal networks. All you do is enforce path consistency. Okay, a path consistency takes, basically path consistency is a tree consistency. So you take three variables, x, y, and z, and compute a new constraint between x and z based on the composition of constraints between x, y, and y, z. And then you take the intersection of that to the original constraint between x and z. That's exactly what you wound up doing. So you took this and this, computed a new constraint between 0 and 3, 40 and 60. You take intersection of 40 and 60 to 0 and 100, that becomes the true constraint now between 0 and 3. And you continue doing this for all possible triples. Okay? And the algorithm essentially is, you keep doing it until nothing changes between two iterations. Okay? So you notice that there is this internal loop where you have an n cube amount of work because you're looking at all possible triples. But then there is an external loop which says keep doing this n cube loop until nobody changes. If you can prove to yourself that you only have to do this whole thing once, you are happy. It's only n cube. If you can't, then it could be worse than n cube. And I'm here to tell you that if you are doing simple temporal problems, you would never have to do this loop more than once. If you are doing disjunctive temporal problems, that means you have, you know, disjunctive intervals, then this thing can go arbitrarily long. In fact, it actually becomes NP hard. So, you know, it's not one. Okay, it could be exponential number of times. Okay, and actually what happens is when you take something like this particular simple TCSP, it's not simple, it's like a 3-point TCSP which has three disjunctive constraints. If you consider its minimal temporal network, that looks like that. Alright, anyway, you can see more or less, I guess, but yeah, looks like that. Now, people always complain that their time is being fragmented. This is what it is, really. You know, it's like the legal happenings between this point and this point is fragmented into these many different intervals. And once you have the minimal network, you know, next time what we'll show is, once, first of all, that in fact if you do have a minimal network, everything else is easy to solve. And one other thing I'll talk about a little, and hopefully depending on how much you need on that, is that for the simple temporal networks, you don't even need to do this. In fact, there is another approach which is probably easier to understand, which essentially converts this kind of a graph into a graph that you understand much more directly with negative edges. Okay, so a 0, 10, 20, 1 becomes 0 to 20, 0 to 1 with a 20 weight and 1 to 0 with a minus 10 weight. It's just a normal graph now. And if you do Floyd-Warshall algorithm on that graph, all pair shortest path algorithm, that will give you everything that you need. That would give you the minimal network. So in fact, you would get the minimal paths between all the pairs using the all pair shortest path. And once you get these minimal distances between the points, you can, you know, something like 1 and 0, you would basically see that 1 and 0 is minus 20, 10, because 0, 1 is 20, 1, 0 is minus 10. That's it. Okay, so we'll talk about that too. But that, this is an idea that works only for simple temporal problems. Okay, for the disjunctive, for the more general idea that works for everybody is this. And this is about path consistency enforcement, which happens to be polynomial for simple temporal problems, but exponential for disjunctive temporal problems. Okay, we'll stop here. Think more about this, you know, look at the paper, and then, you know, I'll use part of the lecture next class to talk about this.